Good morning and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Danny Proud, a member of the program committee. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, your sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age or your abilities or inabilities. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. They're presented either by a Prairie member, a member of the wider community, or by a yet undetermined minister that we will have later on in the year. And today, Frank Siegel will be presenting a presentation on Celtic spirituality. Okay, so now we'll have opening words by Frank Siegel.
The quotation in your program leads into this reflection. One of the losses among all the gains from the ascendancy of science and materialism has been the degeneration of respect for and understanding of myth. Myth has come to be synonymous with lies and deceit and phoniness. We dismiss something by saying, oh, that's just a myth. In correcting outdated or inaccurate beliefs, we call them myths. Myths are what are not true. Only facts are true. We often no longer appreciate that some truths can only be approached through metaphor and symbol. This degeneration of myth by the advance of science may well be rooted in the arrogance of our own monotheistic traditions, which abrogated all truth only to themselves, and which sowed some of the seeds of Western imperialism and encouraged genocide against the heathen savages. What we should try to do in the deepest part of ourselves is to find the truths and meaning within humanity's sacred texts and traditions.
Dorothy will light the chalice while Frank and I read some poetry.
I thought you were going to go first with Bless.
Oh. This is a poem by Davithop Gwilym written in the which century?
16th.
A ceiliog sechor e son, bronfaith dilediaeth loidon, deg loiwiaeth doi eglawais, down vad lon, dan vedu eglais, pa rhyw ddim a fai berach, plethiaid noi chwibaniaid bach, plygain y dathau deirthith, pli yw i gasil i unplith, peth y clywyr uwch tirioedd, a lev o luin I loyu vloid, prof wid rhyw praf audir hoid, pen cerdd gloyu anger glen goid, pob llais diwael yn ail nant, a gan e boi gi nwfiant, pob caniad mad midr angerdd, pob cainc o'r organ, pob cerdd, pob cwlwm addwyn mwyn merch, am rason am o'r eisech. Pregethwr a sylwyr thein, per e wybr pyr a iawen, prydydd cerdd ofydd di fai, primas mwyn prif urddas mai.
Yesterday, I heard the cock thrush with loving song in pure and limpid tone and diction fine and clear. Suspiciously endowed from underneath the birch trees came his voice. What sweeter composition could there be than his diminutive whistling? For matins, three lessons he reads in our midst. Feathers are his chasuble, Far off across these lands is heard his voice from out the thicket, and his clear, loud shout. He is the hillside's prophet, longing's powerful author, bright poet of passion in the wooded glen. Each clear accent on the valley's brow he sings, impelled by dear vivacity, each happy song and poetry's art. Each stave of music, every tune, each gentle melody to please a girl debating over love's priorities. He is a preacher. He reads lections. Sweet, pure, and undimmed is his inspiration. His is the faultless poet of Ovid's craft of song, a gentle primate of the great order of May. I know him from his birchwood trysting place. He leads all woodland's birds in song, a joyful chorus from the lovely glade. Of all the odes and measures that belong to love, he is a merry bird who sings in hazel trees in the fair forest, a winged angel. It were a wonder if the expert birds of paradise who love him could revolving memories store with artistry, recite all the songs he sang.
Children of all ages can come up to the front for a story.
This is a story from the land of Cornwall. Cornwall is a tiny little piece of land at the very southwest part of Britain. Here is a map showing Cornwall. Cornwall is here, this is England, over here. This is the tale of Even. There was a man and woman living in the parish of Llanlavan, in the place which is called Howth, and work became scarce, so the man said to his wife, I'm going to go look for work, and you can stay here and tend the garden. So he left and traveled a long, long way, and at last came to the house of a farmer and asked for work. Well, what work can you do? Said the farmer. I can do all kinds of work, said Even. Then they agreed upon 3 pieces of gold for the year's wages. When the end of the year came, his master showed him the 3 pieces of gold. See, Even, here's your wage, but if you'll give it me back, I'll give you a piece of advice instead. Give me my wage, said Even. No, I'll not, said the farmer. I'll explain my advice. Tell it me then, said Even. Never leave the old road for the sake of a new one. After that, they agreed for another year at the old wages, and at the end of it, Even took instead a piece of advice. And this was it. Never lodge where an old man is married to a young woman. The same thing happened at the end of the 3rd year, when the piece of advice was, honesty is the best policy. But Even would not stay any longer, but wanted to go back to his wife. 3 years. Don't go today, said his master. My wife bakes tomorrow, and she shall make thee a cake to take home to thy good woman. And when Even was about to leave, here, said his master, here is a cake for thee to take home to thy wife. And when ye are most happy together, then break the cake, but not sooner. So he took leave of them and traveled towards home. And at last he came to Polperil. And there he met 3 merchants from Treirin. And they were coming home from Exeter Fair, across the border. Oho, Even, said they. Come with us. Glad we are to see ye. Where have ye been so long? I've been in service, said Even. And now I'm going home to my wife.
Well, come with us. You're right. Be right welcome. But when they took the new road, even kept to the old one. And robbers fell upon the merchants before they had gone far from even as they were going by fields and houses in the meadow. They began to cry out, "Thieves! Thieves!" And even shouted out, "Thieves too!" And when the robbers heard even shout, they ran away. And the merchants went by the new road and even by the old one till they met again at Market Jew. "Oh, even," said the merchants, we are so thankful to you. But for you, we would have been robbed. Come lodge with us at our cost." When they came to the place where they were to stay, even said, "I must see the host." "The host," they cried, "what do you want with the host? Here is the hostess, and she's young and pretty. If you want to see the host, you'll find him in the kitchen." So he went into the kitchen to see the host, and he found him a weak, old man cooking on the stove. "Uh-oh," thought even, "I'll not lodge here. I'll go next door." "Not yet," said the merchants. "Stay, have supper with us, and you'll be welcome." Now it happened that the hostess had plotted with a certain monk in Market Jew to murder the old man in his bed that night while the rest were asleep, and they agreed to lay it on the merchants. So while even was in bed next door, there was a hole in the pine end of the house, and he saw a light through it. So he got up and looked, and heard the monk speaking. "I had better cover this hole," said he, "or people in the next house may see what we are doing." So he stood with his back against it while the hostess killed the old man. But meanwhile, even came out with his knife, and putting it through the hole, he cut a round piece off the monk's robe. The very next morning, the hostess raised the cry that her husband was murdered, and there was neither man nor child in the house but the merchants. And she declared they ought to be thrown into jail. So they were taken and carried to prison till at last even came to them. "Oh, even," they cried, "bad luck sticks to us. Our host was killed last night, and we're stuck in jail." "Tell the judges," said even, "to summon the real murderers." "Who knows," they replied, "who committed the crime?" "Who committed the crime? If I cannot prove who committed the crime, put me in jail in your stead." So he told all he knew and brought out the piece of cloth from the monk's robe. And with that, the merchants were free, and the hostess and the monk were put in jail. And they all came together out of Market Jew, and they said to him, "Come as far as the wood of the heap of stones of watching in the parish of Berman." Then their two roads separated, and though the merchants wished him to go with him, he would not go with them, but went straight to him, home to his wife. And when his wife saw him, she said, "Home in the nick of time. Here's a purse of gold that I found. It has no name. But sure, it belongs to the great Lord yonder. I was just thinking what to do when you came." Then even thought of the third piece of advice, and he said, "Let us go and give it to the great Lord." So they went up to the castle, but when the great Lord was not in it, they gave it to the purse to the servant that minded the castle, and they went home and lived quiet for a while. But one day, the great Lord stopped at their house for a drink of water. And even's wife said to him, "I hope your lordship found your lordship's purse quite safe with all its money in it."
"What purse are you talking about?" said the Lord.
"Sure, it's your lordship's purse that I left at the castle."
"Come with me and we'll see into the matter," said the Lord.
So even his wife went up to the castle, and there they pointed out the man to whom they'd given the purse. And he had to give it up,
and was fired and had sent away from the castle. And the Lord was so pleased with Eben that he made him the servant in the place of the guy who stole the purse. "Honesty is the best policy," quote said Eben as he skipped about in his new fancy quarters. "How happy I am." Then he thought of his master's cake, that he was to eat it when he was happiest. And when he broke it, lo and behold, it inside was his wages for the 3 years he had been with him.
We're incorporating a lot of Celtic music today from the different, there are six or debatably seven Celtic nations, and this one is from the Isle of Man, is that right?
Yeah. You got the music.
Here it is. You might have guessed, Frank is a good friend of mine, an old friend of mine. Frank Siegel graduated from college with degrees in history and theater. And in the past few decades has pursued his interest in all things Celtic, especially in music and spirituality. And he served in leadership roles in Minnesota with the St. David's Welsh Society and the St. Piran's Cornish Society, and on the Celtic Festival Weekend Planning Committee, and currently he's the president of the Greater Kansas City Cornish Society. He was a founding member of the Seward Cafe Collective in Minneapolis, where he worked for 27 years, and he was vice president of Seward Redesign, a neighborhood community development program. Frank is an elder of the neo-pagan Nest, Our Lady of Lakes, Church of All Worlds, and a member of the Methodist Church in Manhattan, Kansas, where he lives with his wife, Mary. He and I have sung and played Welsh and Pan-Celtic music for over 10 years together in the folk bands Cerddoriaeth Ceiniog and Woad, and we both sing with the North American Welsh Choir. Please welcome Frank Siegel.
We're going to be doing some singing and reciting, and when we get to the point of the litany, I'd like this side to be group one, and this side group two. The tune for both the Navajo prayer and
St. Patrick's breastplate as morning has broken, which I'm sure most of us know. If you're uncomfortable singing Christian words, that's fine. I sometimes wonder how different our religious history might have been if the Christian church had not been grafted onto the Roman Empire. If the Celtic form of Catholic Christianity, which arose in the Isles as Imperial Rome collapsed, had greater influence than it was able to achieve before becoming subservient fully to Rome. The first candle. Fare and solus beg, Aaron Chargauen, Honum e dan thrastel den spirit, Costum agus mirnum asolus show, Ernos den vert credu, Son relta den nart hollis. The green. Once upon a time, long, long ago, at the beginning of tales, when people and the divine were still on speaking terms, there was a mountain paradise, and there was the great tree of life that connected the earth with the heavens at the pole star. That star, seemingly fixed in the night sky, was the apex of a constellation some saw as an elk and some as a bear. And the number of stars were 7, and that took on mystical significance. People wandered away for whatever reasons they had, and the mountain receded into the mists, and the way to it was lost. Some people wandered far to the east, following the hunt and steering by the pole star, crossing the Ice Age land bridge to a vast new land. And as they moved south, found it to be rich and beautiful. I imagine they gave thanks to the great bear in the sky for its guidance. These people noted the interdependence and beauty of existence, and the Navajos did a chant that I've set to Morning Has Broken. Beauty before me, beauty behind me, above and below me, beauty is there. Beauty surrounds me, and she immerses me in my young days and in my old age. Beauty before behind me, above and below me, beauty is there. I shall walk quietly the beautiful trail, begun in beauty, in beauty the end. Other people did not move very far from that mythic, from that mountain and tree, leaving them to the north in their own tradition. Then a very different wandering people bumped up against them around Lake Baikal in the Altai Mountains of Western Siberia. And these were the Indo-Aryans. And then they turned south to India and Mesopotamia, taking and refining the tales as they moved and came into contact with other peoples. The mountain was christened Meru by these Indo-Aryans, and later a branch of this people, the Scythians, carried the traditions with their native twin deities, Artemis and Apollo, to their long-lost cousins, the Greeks. Well, around 2000 BCE, the Sumerians compared notes with these Indo-Aryan wonders and found connections with their own beliefs and were influenced by the wondrous tales. As Semites conquered Sumer, the traditions entered into their culture and were further refined, and one of the lore carriers might have been he who became Abraham. The tales and traditions weave a web across cultures and languages, and each uses them in its own way, but always finding in the night sky the pole star, the mystic number, and the great bear, and in their hearts the tree of life and the divine mountain, and a sense of lost past and roots, and a yearning to return. Then in the Alps and Danube Valley, there were a people that the Greeks called Keltoi. They were Indo-Europeans, and they were one of the vast numbers of people coming from those nomadic tribes which spoke a common language or dialects of a common language. Many scholars locate in southern Russia of 4000 BCE. A distinct Celtic identity exists from around 800 to 1000 BCE, maybe earlier. As their influence grew beyond their cradle, they came in contact with the East with their Scythian cousins, and in the West with the original non-Indo-European inhabitants of Europe, and of course Romans and Greeks. The people the Greeks and Romans described were probably only an aristocratic minority warrior and intellectual class. The people who adopted and influenced Celtic speech and culture were probably predominantly non-Indo-Europeans, especially in the British Isles. At their height, Celtic language and cultures covered an area rivaling the empires of Alexander and Rome. The Romans called them Gauli, and the Greeks Galatai, as well as Celts. They held sway from the British Isles to almost the Rock of Gibraltar, from the Low Countries to central Italy, across southern Germany into eastern Europe and the Balkans, and even into Asia Minor. The Apostle Paul wrote an epistle to Celts in Asia Minor, whose province, on some maps, still bears the name Galatia, and whose city still exists, Ankara. There is Galicia in Poland and Galicia in Spain. The sense of who they were at their deepest core can be found in their art. An unbroken line from the artifacts at Hallstatt in Austria of 800 years BCE, from brilliant ornamental metalwork to the magnificent Book of Kells, to the complex intricacy of Cynghanedd, the ancient poetic forms of Wales, to the skirl of pipes and the swirl of harp and the vocal embroidery of the Shan Nos a cappella song of the Gael. Now, what is the character of these art forms? The open-ended curve. It's fluid, free, and individually imaginative and expressive. It's as if the Celts had created in all aspects of art a kind of jazz. The open-ended curve has infinite possibilities, coexistence of the concrete and the imagined, the aliveness and vitality and energy in even the most inanimate object. From the Scythians, they took to riding horses and wearing trousers. They also adopted the Scythian cult of the head as the seat of the soul, so they collected the heads of their vanquished. Sometimes even made them into drinking goblets. From the old tale of the tree and the mountain and the great bear, they may have brought that from the Scythians. Bear in Celtic as Artos, which later becomes Arthur. From the more ancient peoples to their west, they may have ameliorated their Indo-European patriarchalism with a respect and an accepted status for women not to be equaled until the 20th century. They introduced iron into Western Europe, were the first to shoe horses, developed the iron plowshare, built the first roads, taught the Greeks and Romans about soap, and invented the reaper, which was lost for centuries until it was developed by another Celt, Cyrus McCormick. They made their fortunes from mining, metal craft, and trade, as well as agriculture and husbandry, and looting, pillaging, and cattle rustling. They were vigorous and optimistic. Alexander the Great asked the Celtic delegation if they did not have something they feared, figuring that he was probably an object of fear. I mean, everybody feared Alexander. The reply was that they feared nothing or no man, only possibly the sky falling on their heads. Alexander concluded that the Celts were insufferable braggarts. Well, what had they to fear? Death was but a passage between worlds. The spirit and material worlds were contiguous and omnipresent, more so at some times of the year than others. So there was nothing to be afraid of. If you want to know the origin of many ideas in science fiction, you need to look no further than the lore of the Celts. Time travel, no problem. Parallel universes, sure. Questing and adventure, oh, definitely. Avalon, the underground world of the Shi, the Isles of the Blessed, the land under the waves, the land of youth, all were just a step or a rowboat away. Spirit pervades everything. Rocks, wells, animals, trees, springs, stars, sun, moon, the earth herself, and can drift from one to another as if connected by some spiritual wormhole. The first two Celtic poets we know of both wrote similar shamanic-like chants, which you have as a litany. I know why there is an echo in a hollow.
Why silver gleams?
Why breath is black? Why liver is black?
Why milk is white?
Why holly is green?
Why is it here? Why water now is hollow?
Why brine is salt?
Why ale is bitter?
Why linen is green and berries
red?
Why cuckoo complains?
Why it sings?
I know where the cuckoos of summer are in winter. I know what beasts there are at the bottom of the sea. How many spears in battle? How many drops in a shower?
Why fishes have scales?
Why a swan has black feet?
I am the wind that blows over the sea. I am a wave of the sea. I am lowing of the sea. Caesar wrote that it took 20 years for a candidate to become a full-fledged druid, male or female. A druid was a walking encyclopedia. a custodian by memory of all knowledge, science, lore, law, history, song, and ritual of the people. Language was as much a living thing as any other, vital and dynamic. To write it down was, in a sense, to kill it. As a result, there are few examples of Celtic language before the rise of the six present Celtic languages of the Celtic fringe. Brief inscriptions, mostly on stone, generally patronymics or dedications to various gods or goddesses. Invocations and curses, and the Caligny calendar, which gives us evidence of their time reckoning, which was extremely accurate. There were elements of two religious traditions that were considered to be a potential threat to the Roman Empire: Druidism and Judaism. Both were sources of sedition and rebellion, and both were suppressed. Caesar destroyed the sacred groves of Gaul and banned the Druids. They had to go underground. A later Roman general did likewise to the Grove and College on the Isle of Anglesey in Britain, and slaughtered the Druids and their families. Later, there would be a third faith, which talked of a crucified man who was also God. The crime that rated crucifixion in the empire was sedition and rebellion. The second candle. Gunan canair galaini bach hun ar wine bathair, casegrav hun agrosanai thrasprid. Am the finna of a cleather galaini hun vel ar with view, a waithred feeth meun realaith ner a galaini. Until Christianity became the religion of the Roman state, it was one of many religious alternatives in the empire. Sometimes persecuted and a scapegoat, sometimes tolerated, but not within itself. You can't help, in reading Paul's epistle to the Galatians, feeling the seeds of the later conflict between the Celtic Christian style of the British Isles and Rome, or the insistence of the Irish to remain Catholic in the face of English Protestantism, or the other Celts of the Isles becoming stubbornly nonconformist. One can almost hear Paul telling them to stop being easily swayed and stubborn Celts and toe the party line, his. It's said that if you have any three Celts together, you have five opinions. And yet, of all the areas in the world that were Christianized in the early going, once it was legitimized, there were no martyrs in the Isles. It seemed as if Christianity was just the next road in the Celtic quest. But who absorbed whom when Christians converted Celtic pagans? A triune God was easily accepted and understood. After all, there was in Celtic tradition the triple goddess, sometimes called Brigantia in Britain and the continent, who is Bridget in modern Anglo-Irish, and was canonized. Mary, the mother of God, made perfect Celtic sense. Gods and goddesses became saints or heroes, and the remaining Druids put aside the Triskelion, the badge of their office, for the Celtic cross, and many became monks. They moved back and forth. St. Patrick was a British Celt. The patron saint of Cornish miners, St. Piran, came from Ireland, where he was known as Ciaran of Sire. Their inspiration was not only the local culture into which they were born, but also the desert fathers of the Middle East, especially Egypt, who went off singly into the wilderness to live the ascetic life. In the Isles, people were attracted to these solitaries, and communities grew up around them. True to Celtic culture, these seekers of God could be male or female, both sometimes living in community together, and both equally officiating at the Mass. St. Non of Wales, who may have been Irish, gave birth to St. David. Here was created a special form of Catholic Christianity exemplified by the words of St. Patrick's breastplate, an inclusive Christianity that saw existence, spirit, and Christ interweaved in both immanence and transcendence. I'm going to sing first in Gaelic, and then we'll join with in the English. Christlium, Christrum, Christi moiae, Christus tierum, Christum, Christos mochon, Christer molaias, Christer mochle, Christin molidum, Christi mohasu, Christin lacrie quiniorum, Christin nachbel, Christin nachzu, Christin nachlus, aestianlium. Christ be with me, Christ before me, Christ behind me, Christ within, Christ below me, Christ above me, Christ on my right hand, Christ on my left, Christ in my sleeping, Christ in my waking, Christ in the hearts which think of me, Christ in the mouth of all who speak to me, Christ in each eye that looks to me. Consider this cross, typically made from one hunk of stone. It may well remind one of the Native American medicine wheel or a mandala. The cross is the hub and spokes of the great wheel, which may also represent the sun, and can be said to represent the great tree of life. And the cross is often embossed with a Celtic braid of interconnectedness for all existence. Spirit and matter is connected and holy. Is it solely Christian or is it adopted by Christians? Depends on your point of view. The oldest stone crosses in the aisles, like this, are from the Christian era. But cruder ones, etched on stone, rather like it, date from thousands of years earlier. One could say that the Druids survived and changed, yet remained the same. Shape shifted in good Celtic fashion, and the Celts maintained their identity and gave the new faith their own special weave. Anche Georg on Champel, Nihes Georg on Altar. Whoever is nearest the church is not nearest the altar. That's Irish. Poagasa vereglis pechaver buradwis. Nearest the church, farthest from heaven. That's Welsh. Armadu bras an andriu deus de saint arad yalu. Riches and honors make devils of saints. That's Breton. Thomas Cahill, in his book, How the Irish Saved Civilization, shows how Ireland was the seat and the dispersal of learning in the so-called Dark Ages as Irish monks, the Peregrini, or pilgrims, carried the faith and learning and knowledge across Europe from Iceland to Russia. This was in the period prior to the first schism that divided the church into Roman Catholic and Orthodox. The Celtic style had more in common with the Eastern Greek and Middle Eastern sensibility than with the conventional Roman expression, as exemplified by the conic aspects of the Book of Kells, as well as its approach to the material world. In his book, Wisdom of the Celtic Saints, Edward Selner, who teaches at the College of St. Catherine in St. Paul, Minnesota, writes, "In many ways, this Celtic spirituality is the foundation of Anglican, Episcopalian, and Methodist spirituality, and because of its love of the desert fathers and mothers, it has a great affinity with the spirituality of the Eastern Orthodox. With its focus on nature and the entire spiritual realm, and its respect for ancestors' visions and dreams, it finds resonance with Native American spirituality, too. Thus, the spirituality of the Christian Celts has great ecumenical value. It also has special appeal for many of us today who are concerned about the ecological survival of the planet." Well, that might be. But the Reformation, particularly in its most strict and staid forms, attempted with varying success to expunge what it saw as pagan, Celtic, Catholic idolatry and superstition. A Scottish Parliamentary Act of 1581 complained, "The dregs of idolatry yet remain in divers parts of the realm by using of pilgrimage to some chapels, wells, crosses, and such other monuments of idolatry, as also by observing the festal days of the saints, sometimes named their patrons, in setting forth of bonfires, singing of carols within and about kirks at certain seasons of the year." How this sacrilege was can be read in the Carmina Gedelica, a monumental work that took decades to complete, containing prayers, invocations, and other religious observances gleaned from the common folk of the Highlands. John Wesley, the founder of the Methodists, tried his best, along with his estranged friend George Whitfield, to stamp out the rowdier forms of Celtishness in Wales and Cornwall. Could they succeed where the crown had had trouble doing it? The church did take root, but took on its own Celtic stamp. In the case of Wales, it emerged with the chapels, circuit riders, and Sunday schools in the tradition of the Gaman Vagani, that unleashing of hwyl, enthusiasm and joy, in congregational hymn singing. The Cornish and the Welsh will sing a hymn anywhere. Doesn't make any difference. Church, okay. Pub, of course. Rugby matches, absolutely. In this tale, mythical and historical, we in a sense have intertwined the warp and woof of the plaid, the weave of sound and season, the sense of place and clan, the love of nature and one's bit of ground, the Christ within as well as the Christ beyond, the purifying energy of fire, the life-giving, life-taking, life-sustaining and healing water, the adventure of life and death, the ancestors who are with us wherever we wander on whatever quest is ours. The sense of longing for what is fading or lost, which in Welsh is hiraeth. And of course, I've been talking about the Christian end. We know that it's also on the neo-pagan side. Wiccans celebrate the Celtic holidays. The Fianna, the troop of warriors who were led by Finn McCool, were debating music one day. One of them said that the sweetest sound was the clash of spear on shield. Another said it was the swell of the sea on the shore. Another said it was the sigh of a well and thoroughly loved maiden. They turned to Finn. He thought for a moment and then said, "The sweetest sound is the music of what happens." The third candle. Kindle this little light on the earth plane. I dedicate it to the service of the Spirit. I guard and cherish this light as a living symbol and as an act of faith in the reality of the powers of light.
Okay.
We've come to the end of the service. We're all out of time now. So Frank will be. I think you'll be happy to stay afterwards and answer questions. So please stay afterwards and feel free to talk with Frank. Okay.
Closing words.
Peace of the running wave to you, the peace of the flowing air to you, the peace of the quiet earth to you, the peace of the shining stars to you, and the peace of the Son of Peace to you. Christ, the word incarnate, peace.